This is docket number 80693. Welcome, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Okay, you ready to begin? All right, would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for purposes of rebuttal.
Okay, here we go.
May it please the court, my name is E. Brent Bryson. I'm arguing on behalf of appellants today. As I just stated, I'll use 11 minutes for my argument, 4 minutes for purposes of rebuttal. The trial court's judgment was erroneous, unjust, and not based in fact or law. The purpose of the instant action was to collect a prior judgment in the amount of $2,608,799 that was against Las Vegas Land Partners LLC, LVLP for purposes of the hearing, only. No attorney's fees were awarded in that underlying action. The trial court in this action, in its findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment, concluded that compensatory damages on the civil conspiracy cause of action were $15,148,339. Also awarded attorney's fees in the amount of $4,493,176.90 for a grand total of $19,641,515.90. That total amount on the civil conspiracy claim is almost eight times the original underlying judgment. It's important to note that the trial court did not find that punitive damages were warranted. However, the sum of $19,641,515.90 cannot be considered anything but punitive. And even if punitive damages had been awarded, they would have been capped at three times compensatory. There's no basis in reality for the numbers that the trial court used. In order to recover on a claim for civil conspiracy, the damages awarded are not because it's a civil conspiracy, but it has to do with the harm that the civil conspiracy caused. Here, the most that the civil conspiracy could have caused would have been the amount of the underlying judgment. Now, basically, the trial court found a civil conspiracy based upon two theories. One, certain distributions that were taken by Mitchell and Lieberman for the years of 2007 through 2016, and the fabrication of evidence. The Eichelberger case clearly states that a fabrication of evidence cannot serve as the basis for civil conspiracy. So wipe out that theory. As to the civil conspiracy prong one, there was insufficient evidence to demonstrate that the distributions that were taken by Mitchell and Lieberman were unlawful, and that's what you must show for a civil conspiracy cause of action, that the action was unlawful. In other words, the underlying tort or basis for the civil conspiracy is unlawful, and then you have to show what the harm was. Now, all of the distributions that were taken by Mitchell and Lieberman, most of them were taken between 07 and 09, all except for 4,700. NIPE was aware, as of August and July of 2011, based upon NIPE's expert report, that NIPE produced in the underlying action, where Judgment 1 was, that's Trial Exhibit 90079, AA3525 through 43. Now, the one thing the trial court did that was correct is the trial court time-barred all of the alleged fraudulent conveyance transactions, except for one, which was the Coolidge transaction that occurred in 2014. We submit that time-barred transactions cannot serve as an unlawful act or objective based upon Nevada law. Those are the cases of Jordan, Flowers, and Schwartz. Thus, the transfers and distributions were time-barred, all except for perhaps the Coolidge transaction. Now, we know that there was at least, in addition to the report by Knipe's expert, we know that there was a meeting in the summer of 2007 where Mitchell allegedly told Knipe that you're not going to get paid on the amount that you want. We know that because it's found at the, based upon the discovery responses that were attached in the record on appeal as AA2184 through 88. Additionally, Knight testified at trial and admitted that he knew about these distributions that left the parent LLC, the parent corporation, if you will, LLC, the entity, as of 2011. So he knew as of 2011 and was placed on notice that there was, quote, conspiracy conduct with the underlying wrongful act being the fraudulent distributions. The tax returns produced by Knipe in the underlying action demonstrate completely that he was aware of the depleted financial condition of LLP in 2011. Now, it's important when we talk about this one transfer, the Coolidge, that the court didn't find was time barred. The Coolidge was not a judgment debtor under the law at that time. Coolidge was not owned by Mitchell. Coolidge had its own separate bank account, and Coolidge occurred in 2014 prior to the unpublished case of Magliotti, which came out in 2019. There's a lot of factual overlap when I mention this. There's a lot of factual overlap that also goes into the fraudulent conveyance as well as the alter ego causes of action.
Mr. Bryson, with regard to the Coolidge transaction, it's my understanding that the basis for the court finding that there was a fraudulent transaction and fraudulent conveyance or fraudulent transfer involved with that is that the proceeds that came in to the LVLP subsidiary from that a good chunk of that was distributed out to Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Lieberman. It wasn't that Coolidge was a problem per se. It's that the distribution of the proceeds by the subsidiary of the judgment debtor was the problem. Is that your understanding?
Well, of that, there was approximately $250,000 that was taken by Mitchell, and I think it was $91,000 and some change. I have the exact figure someplace here. But in answer to your question, but it's important to remember that they were not the judgment debtors at that time. They were not judgment debtors at that time. The judgment
subsidiary entity.
Yes, but
you mean though, is it Leah was the entity? I don't recall if I have that correct.
It was sold from Leah to Casino Coolidge.
Right. So the proceeds from the sale, $1 million, as I understand it, went to Leah, and Leah was a subsidiary of LVLP, the judgment debtor.
That's correct. But there was no substantial evidence that was submitted during the trial that these were wrongful distributions. And the Magliotti case hadn't come out until 2019 on that. So as of the date of the Coolidge transaction, which was 2014, there was nothing unlawful about those distributions. They were entitled to take those distributions. Furthermore, their expert, Knipe's expert, Mr. Rich, could not say that the monies did not ultimately make their way back to LVLP. He didn't understand why, or could have had no explanation as to why the distributions were in different amounts. And so there was no, quote, substantial evidence that was presented at trial. You have Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Lieberman testifying that the distributions they took were to pay back personal loans, to pay back expenses, things that were incurred in the facilitation of the business deals, because the bank in New York that they primarily use would not lend money for the acquisition or development of property outside the state of New York.
But this was a bench trial, and the district judge made findings based on her evaluation of the evidence, albeit perhaps conflicting, which is a differential standard that we apply in that circumstance, correct?
That is correct. However, there's exceptions to the differential standard where the trial court's ruling is clearly erroneous or is not substantiated by substantial evidence. And here, it wasn't substantiated by substantial evidence. The Coolidge transaction, any of the other distributions, and quite frankly, the only way you're ever going to get to liability, because remember, the original judgment debtor is LVLP, is by way of alter ego. So you have to use the reverse alter ego analysis that even now is currently not Nevada law under Moglietti. I mean, it may become Nevada law that a transferee or non-transferee is liable for the debts of a judgment creditor under a theory of alter ego. But that wasn't the law in 2014.
But in terms of how do you get from $2 million to $19 million, the initial wrong was not paying Knipe money that he alleged and established in trial one that he was entitled to for introductions that he made to facilitate the development of this property. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so just as a commercial matter, set aside the avoidance of this judgment and non-payment of it and whatever allegations go with that. Was there another affirmative allegation that Knipe provided benefit, commercial benefit, to the people on the other side of the caption that he was entitled to be paid for separate and apart from the $2 million he established his right to in the first trial?
No, and that's the fallacy of the judgment on this case, is you can't get to that number under any stretch of the imagination. You can't get from $2,608,799 to the exorbitant amount of $19,641,515.90, which includes, as I said, almost $5 million in attorney's fees.
And are there emotional distress damages in there?
Can't be.
It's argued in the briefs, but it caught my eye and then I couldn't find it in the findings.
There can't be. Number one, they weren't asked for in the complaint. There's no cause of action for emotional distress. There's no findings of fact, conclusions of law, or judgment for emotional distress by the trial court. And counsel for Knipe did not make any type of motion at the trial to conform or amend the complaint to conform to the evidence that was adduced, and even at trial. And even then, it was a brief comment that says we'd like a little bit for emotional distress.
Distress associated with trying to collect the $2 million judgment or something else?
The emotional distress trying to collect the $2 million judgment and this distress of having to litigate the matter in general. You can't get attorney's fees in this case for the underlying case. No attorney's fees were awarded in the underlying case. In the instant case,
but they're saying they had to chase, they incurred fees trying to chase these guys to collect judgment. I mean, so
there's only three exceptions to get attorney's fees. Absent a contractual provision, a statute, or rule, there's only three exceptions to get attorney's fees under the case of Sandy Valley. One, third-party dispute regarding breach of contract or tortious conduct. Two, recovery of real or personal property, which is like a conversion because it says recovery. And three, declaratory equitable relief. None of those exceptions apply in the incident action. So there's no basis for attorney's fees on the incident action.
Let's assume for the moment that we do think that attorney's fees are available. How would you have somebody plead attorney's fees as special damages if not the way it was done here under each cause of action asking for attorney's fees? I mean, what language should have been used there in your mind?
Well, the language, first of all, there's case law that is Nevada case law that is well established that just praying for attorney's fees in the prayer is not good enough.
Right.
That's one. The same language that was used in the prayer was also used after each cause of action. I submit not good enough because it's the same language. You would have to plead, in answer to your question, you would have to plead language so that it logically follows as a consequence from the harm. So in other words, for example, in this particular case, I incurred special damage as a result of having to collect or having to chase the judgment of $2.8 million in the instant action. But remember, even in this action, there was no fees that were requested for the underlying action.
Understood. But you're essentially positing that under Rule 9, the specificity mentioned there would include something related to the nature of the facts in the case.
Absolutely. Otherwise, you just have the general language that this court has said is not good enough.
Okay.
So if the complaint had said, I'm seeking attorney's fees as an element of special damages for the Coolidge transaction and having to recover that inappropriate fraudulent transfer, that would have been enough.
I think you'd have to clarify slightly more, but certainly you're on the right track there. It's more than the general prayer that we say is not good enough.
Well, I've been fairly specific. If the amended complaint or had said, I want to recover my attorney's fees for having to chase down this $341,000, and I'm incurring these fees because of this fraudulent transfer, that would have been a sufficient prayer for special damages under Sandy Valley, right?
Under Sandy Valley and NRCP 9G, I would say probably, but it would have to be to the damages that were recovered in the instant action, not the underlying action.
Well, I understand that.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, I think that would be appropriate, but that language wasn't contained.
It's a different issue. And returning to the Coolidge transaction, I get your point that neither Mitchell or Lieberman were at the time of that transaction judgment debtors, but LVLP was.
Oh,
right.
LVLP was the judgment debtor. That's correct.
Yeah. And so, what's wrong with conclusion 14 and finding of fact 33 in these findings?
You're talking about the findings of fact, conclusions of law.
Yeah. I mean, 14 says, in effect, it's a fraudulent transfer because Lieberman and Mitchell took the money instead of Leah's parent, LVLP.
At that particular time, at the time the distribution was made, there was no alter ego finding, and it wasn't unlawful under the law.
We're talking about a fraudulent transfer, not alter ego here. This is a fraudulent transfer of money that should have gone to the LLC's owner, LVLP, right?
I respectfully disagree with that.
Well, what evidence did you put on to show that these two guys were entitled to the money?
The evidence that was put on is that the...
What evidence did you put on that these two gentlemen were entitled to the money?
There was trial...
these proceeds.
There was trial testimony that these distributions were to pay back loans and business expenses that were incurred personally by these individuals to facilitate the transaction.
I understand that was a general... That was their general testimony.
That's correct.
Any connection whatsoever. We made loans to Leah on this date, and Leah owes us this amount of money.
I'm not aware of a specific finding such as what you're talking about, okay. Justice.
All right. And then to follow up on the issue about attorney's fees, your argument here is that the district court awarded fees from the underlying action.
That's part of it,
principally,
yes.
Principally the concern, well, one of the main concerns anyway. and the issue you have with attorney's fees for this action, not the underlying action, is that they were not properly pled as attorney's fees for special damages.
Well, yes, that's correct. They were not properly pled as special damages. And
so they wouldn't be recoverable at all because of that.
That's correct. Okay. And the damage amount that was requested was the $1,274,337.90, subject to additional fees for December of 2019 and January of 2020, which totaled $59,076.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you so much. And even under that analysis, you can see that it's not $4 million, almost $5
million. Right. I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and you kind of chewed into your rebuttal time. I'll give you 2 minutes. We asked you a few questions, and I'll offer your opposing counsel 2 additional minutes as well.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. First and foremost, I need to clarify the record just a little bit. We are representing Russell Knight, Revenue Plus LLC, his operating business real estate entity, and perhaps most importantly, the LVLP Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustee, Shelley Crone. And that's one of the things that strikes me very significantly here. In a last second effort to try to avoid discovery sanctions in August of 2019, LVLP ran down to the courthouse and filed bankruptcy, hoping that they would freeze everything and they'd be able to delay the trial for another 2 years. Well, after Ms. Crone conducted a 341 and was given certain information, she decided these guys were very, very bad characters, guilty of all sorts of misconduct over a span of more than a decade. And she intervened and she joined Mr. Knipe and his company in chasing these guys to undo the harm that they had caused, not only to Mr. Knipe, but to their other creditors. This goes back to just showing the basis of a case. We have an experienced judge, Judge Gonzalez, who I believe was a main character in creating the business court in Las Vegas. She was certainly experienced, well-versed, and knew business law. She heard 6 days of evidence, not an hour, not 2 hours, not one witness, not another witness. She heard our expert witness for a day and a half. LVLP and Mr. Mitchell and the defendants put on zero expert witnesses. There was no rebuttal of Mr. Rich's testimony. And after 6 days, she made substantial findings of fact. These were primarily drafted by Judge Gonzalez. She did findings of fact, conclusions of law in detail. And I'll get to a couple of those details as we go along. And her ultimate decision? These guys are bad actors. They lost in front of Judge Israel. Now they're losing in front of me because they're just not credible. And on top of that, they've gone to the Supreme Court twice and lost. And the bankruptcy trustee thinks they're bad guys too, and she's here asking for justice. They caused Mr. Knight 13 years of agony. Cost him his marriage, cost him his ability to earn income, disparaged his business reputation, forced him to sell his primary residence in New York City and mortgage other family property. This was not just you didn't pay a contract. This was we're out to get you, and we're going to do it.
How was that pled in the complaint? You're getting into what Justice Hardesty had touched on.
What you'll see, Your Honor, as we underlie all 5 separate claims for relief, there's about 100 paragraphs as to everything these guys did, including a memorandum that was introduced to evidence. I've got it jotted down a little further in my notes. From the first case, we didn't discover this till the second case, but from the first case it says, yeah, let's go to a bogus settlement conference and move to continue to trial so we can cause additional expense, additional aggravation.
She could have imposed sanctions for that, and there was punitive damages on the table.
Well,
not award, but again.
If
you're pointing at emotional distress damages, where was that pled in the complaint?
I don't have a specific paragraph, Your Honor, other than, again, we detailed the history. We detailed their affirmative efforts to delay and cost Mr. Knight money. I'm pretty sure I used the word aggravation as well as expense. But it came out in testimony, and I have specific references to where questions were asked. How did this impact you?
Complaint amended to conform to the testimony.
We did not file an affirmative motion on that, Your Honor. But again, respectfully, I believe what Judge Gonzalez did, and again, I've lived this case for 7 years, so I have that benefit. I think she looked at it and said, this is really wrong. I could award punitive damages because there's clearly malice and ill will here, but that's probably subject to second guessing and interpretation. No, I'm just going to...
You can't really say that in an order. The this is really wrong, and so I'm going to award $15 million
and
above the $2.6 million judgment that was being...
But Your Honor, that's out of proportion. That $19 million judgment does not shock the conscience. With interest, the day we tried this case, the first judgment was $4.8 million. So it wasn't 2.1 or 2.2. It was up to 4.8.
That's a question, Mr. Muji. Your clients initially got a judgment in 2015, correct?
Correct.
And then the civil conspiracy that formed the basis of that $15 million is what's alleged to have occurred after they obtained their judgment as they were attempting to collect.
We did not find the evidence on that, Your Honor, until we started doing post-judgment discovery.
But the civil conspiracy, this case that's here before us, the civil Correct. Conspiracy was based on things that occurred after you obtained the judgment in 2015.
No, it was based on two things. It was based on what we learned had occurred even prior to the first trial. Distributions which we did not understand. The tax returns showed millions of dollars of assets still in these entities. It's only when we got the bank statements and their ledgers that we saw that there was nothing there.
All right, so we're getting to part of my question, which is Judge Gonzalez appears to have come up with a figure for compensatory damages for civil conspiracy based on the amount that these gentlemen are alleged to have distributed to themselves. How is that compensate for the inability to collect on a $2.6 million judgment?
What she did, Your Honor, and I believe, I haven't had a chance to discuss it, I haven't asked her specifically her thought process, I think she concluded these guys were just terrible men that had malice from day one, but she was going to not set up a punitive judgment that could be reversed on appeal. She was going to make express findings of fact and conclusions of law. They did this, they did this, they did this, they did this. And then she was going to compensate Mr. Knipp for the loss of his marriage, the loss of his business reputation, the loss of his earnings ability,
et cetera. She didn't say that in the order.
Pardon, what's that?
Didn't say that in the order.
But she found general damages. I recognize that the number is a little curious. I would be the first to agree, but my belief is her decision was she's going to divest these individuals of their ill-gotten gains, and the ill-gotten gains were approximately equivalent to the actual damages she found Mr. Knipp sustained.
So I'd like to stick with that theory a second by asking this question.
Certainly.
When you began your argument, you entered an appearance on behalf of the trustee of LVLP.
Correct.
Where in this order and in this appeal is LVLP a party?
It is not, Your Honor. Ms. Shelley Crone, as a trustee, is designated in the findings of fact and conclusions of law as one of the prevailing plaintiff entities, and our briefs were written also representing Shelley Crone, the bankruptcy trustee.
All right.
And I believe that's on the very first page of our brief, Your Honor.
Right, I get that. But I'm looking at the judgment, and I'm trying to figure out.
I have the judgment right here.
It's payable, too.
And the court will note that on the very first page of the judgment, line 4, matter having come on for hearing, plaintiffs Ann Shelley Crone, yeah, bankruptcy trustee, as a plaintiff.
Right.
And then she rendered her rulings in favor of the plaintiffs.
Right.
Part of that was a unique fee arrangement we had approved by the bankruptcy judge that said she could participate, and then the parties, being Mr. Knipp and his company on the one hand and the bankruptcy for LVLP on the other, would split the proceeds 50-50 as opposed to trying to nickel and dime which particular recovery may have gone for which particular item of damage.
So, for example, as we look at the Coolidge transfer.
Correct.
Who's that payable to? All the plaintiffs?
The way it worked out, because we actually did recover some money post-judgment from Coolidge.
Under this judgment, is it payable to all of the...
Of the money we recovered, Mr. Knipp and Revenue Plus received half, and the bankruptcy trustee received half of that recovery.
And that was under a separate agreement between...
That was under an agreement ratified and approved by the bankruptcy court.
Okay. So then... did the trustee enter separate evidence to support a damage claim of $15 million?
She did not. She basically rode along on Mr. Knipp's coattails because when she was appointed, it was less than 6 months before trial, and Mr. Knipp, my office, and even predecessor counsel had literally compiled hundreds and hundreds of volumes, and not to mention that as a result of Judge Gonzalez deeming these guys to be such bad actors that she imposed $160,000 in discovery sanctions on them.
Yeah, I know which got paid, but my question is this. Could you give me the components of the $15 million award here? How does one calculate that amount?
I'm not sure you do calculate it, Judge. It goes back almost, let's pretend that we had a jury sitting here, and they've heard arguments about the loss of income, they've heard arguments about sleepless night, and the dissolution of the marriage, etc. You don't need an expert witness to quantify the damages that emotional distress and aggravation and slander of reputation
cause.
Wait
a minute. You had four claims for relief.
Correct.
Civil conspiracy.
Correct.
Fraudulent transfer.
Correct.
Declaratory relief.
Correct.
And?
Alter ego.
Pardon me?
Alter ego.
Alter ego. Okay. As to the fraudulent transfer, the only fraudulent transfer discussed in the findings is the Coolidge transfer.
Correct, Your Honor.
Quantified.
Except that's a specific equitable remedy for that one transfer that did not fall outside the statute of limitations. Under civil conspiracy, the statute of limitations is different.
Are you saying then that the fraudulent transfer does not operate as a theory of recovery for the $15
million? I think it does, but it operates in a different way, and Judge Gonzalez was very specific on the record on this. She said, no, when you look at a fraudulent conveyance statute of limitation, it's 4 years from the date of transfer, period. Nothing else, four years from the date of transfer.
But Mr. Murji, on the civil conspiracy claim, a civil conspiracy recovery is only possible if there was a conspiracy to commit some underlying wrong.
And
the underlying wrong, not the fraudulent transfer, and if there's more than that, what else?
Multiple, Your Honor.
Okay.
There was an abusive process, which is that memorandum that they consciously delayed and continued the trial for improper grounds. There was a falsification of evidence, and it was the history of fraudulent transfers and running all of the monies through personal accounts, not through corporate accounts. The difference is, Judge Gonzalez found on the record, the statute of limitations may bar a remedy, fraudulent conveyance, but the statute of limitations for a conspiracy is subject to the discovery rule, and we did not discover much of the misconduct and shenanigans that were going on until after the first trial concluded. And that's when we discovered a memo about, we're going to play games with the court, judges will as stupid or won't catch on. That's almost a verbatim quote from that memorandum, and I'm happy to provide a citation to it if the court wants. They delayed things, they ran money through other entities.
So Mr. Knipe originally got involved with the gentleman on the other side here for a business transaction, for opening doors for some kind of real estate development project.
Correct, Your Honor.
Ended up getting a judgment against them, against the entity, LVAP, I want to be specific, to find that he, in fact, did services and was entitled to recover X amount of dollars based on that.
Absolutely.
And then went through all the process you've been describing, trying to collect on that judgment while they were, you know, allegedly, for purposes of my question, handing money around and hiding it from your client, right? Okay.
Well, not only that,
let's assume all that happened. Your position is that based on all of that, a recovery of emotional distress damages is recoverable?
Under a conspiracy of foreseeable consequences of your wrongful acts and misconduct directed at and intended to harm the defendant is recoverable. It's a tort remedy. It's not a contract remedy. And in fact, Judge Gonzalez went through and made multiple specific findings of how this did impact Mr. Knipe and cause damage and harm to him in terms of, again, the disruption of his marriage, the inability to earn money, and the loss of business reputation. And I think what Judge Gonzalez did was, the statute of limitation bars me from looking back at the fraudulent conveyance, but because the statute of limitations on a conspiracy is subject to a discovery rule, and because Mr. Knipe did not discover this activity until after the first trial, the statute of limitations on fraudulent conveyance bars a claim on those fraudulent conveyances, but it doesn't undo the wrong. And she said, under a conspiracy theory, I can go back and look at that wrong and look at everything that those guys did that was evil and malicious and directed at harming Mr. Knight.
So, counsel, finding 41 says, the evidence demonstrates that Mitchell, Lieberman, and the related entities distributed in excess of $15,000 in funds that should have been available to satisfy Knight's claims and judgment.
Correct, Judge.
And then later in 59B, there is a finding that Mitchell and Lieberman took personal distributions from the related entities between 2007 and 2016, totaling $15,148,339. I took those two findings to be the basis of her $15 million award. I think I said 15,000, but I meant to say 15 million. It didn't have anything to do with emotional distress. It didn't have anything to do with inability to marry or get a divorce. It had to do with distributions, and it had to do with distributions that occurred or were occurring from prior to the time you got your basic judgment. Right.
Well, some of those that occurred before. We know that the Coolidge distribution occurred in 2014 during the first trial.
Well, is there a breakdown? That's why I asked you this question. Where did these numbers come from? Is there a breakdown on an exhibit somewhere that points out the distributions that occurred
the exact
year and each amount? Is that in
Rich's? Yes, there is, Your Honor. They're in Mark Rich's expert report,
okay.
And he identifies those amounts.
Okay.
He also says that the accounting was so confused that he couldn't.
Here's the question I'm leading up to.
Okay, good.
Because I find this very unusual, that in a case in which there has been a determination of alter ego post your judgment or a determination of fraudulent transfer post your judgment, that the court awards distributions that are made to principals or to related entities for years before your judgment was even entered. That, what's the legal theory that supports that kind of back reach into those kinds of transactions?
The legal theory, Your Honor, I believe, was that she found this was an ongoing conspiracy that spanned more than a decade. The conduct was directed at Knight. It was wrongful. And let's remember one basis for conspiracy. It doesn't need to be, it is sufficient for a conspiracy count to arise if you do misconduct directed at another individual and engage in a criminal act. We know that Mitchell and his people engaged in a criminal act in fabricating evidence, which is a felony under Nevada law. Judge Gonzalez was so offended by these guys that her decision, I believe, was to divest them of their gains, and her conclusion was that not only was Mr. Knight harmed by the diversion of all this money, but he was harmed personally, he was harmed financially. He had to incur those $4.7 million in attorney's fees to chase these.
You said this several times now that Judge Gonzalez was just so displeased and looked so unfavorably upon these people that she did what she did. The district court judge has to be better than that, right? You can't be driven by an emotional dislike of a party and come up with a figure that you can't bear relation to the harm that was actually caused.
It wasn't a dislike, Your Honor. It was just she was offended and she was appalled by the flagrant, outrageous misconduct.
Why wouldn't that be a perfect basis for punitive damages?
I thought it was, Your Honor, but Judge Gonzalez disagreed with me.
And wouldn't that fit nicely in that lane?
I would have preferred the punitive damage award, but I think Judge Gonzalez was attempting to be conservative.
It's essentially a disgorgement order, is what you're saying. I mean, she goes back and she says every bit of money that got transferred to the people on the other side, and I don't have the names all straight.
I think that was her.
Taken it, and it's, so it's in sort of like an SEC disgorgement order. I mean, that seems to be what you're saying was going on. Plus, he suffered mightily emotionally.
I believe in her mind they were equivalent, and she wanted to reward the guy that suffered and sustained these individual damages and this horrendous.
The whole basis for that is the civil conspiracy claim, legally.
Civil conspiracy, correct, Your Honor.
And the sole setting aside the emotional distress and setting aside the attorney's fees and accountant's fees incurred to chase recovery, but the sole core injury that started this for Knipe was he didn't get paid the $2 million that for the introduction and assistance in bringing the players together for this development in 2007 or whenever.
Well,
it was.
And that was the genesis. Your Honor is absolutely correct.
So there was no further commercial transaction between Knipe and these people that they owed him anything more than the initial $2 million, call it, I don't know, finder's fee or whatever. But there's no other
deal, no other arrangements other than their deal with Forest City precluded Mr. Knipe from earning money from his best upstream contact.
And he got a judgment in front of Judge Israel for that and then was thwarted in its collection.
Correct. Then we went to collection and we discovered that it was much more nefarious than we had originally feared. These guys set out from day one not to pay Mr. Knipe. They distributed the money that was supposed to be held in escrow to pay Mr. Knipe's commission.
I understand that. I just was wanting to confirm.
Okay. Thank you.
Chief, I'm sorry, yes. But I want to ask one hopefully clarifying question. Okay. So I want to understand. The underlying litigation and underlying judgment was against LVLP.
Correct.
Okay. Now, as a result of the trial that's up on appeal now, Judge Gonzalez found that all these other entities and the individuals were all alter egos of LVLP and thus are all subject to that underlying judgment to the same extent as LVLP.
Also right? Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, now. But are you saying that, or I guess did the judge say, that now that she's found as a result of this trial, that all these people and entities are alter egos of LVLP, that any distributions they made before this alter ego finding and indeed before the underlying judgment was entered become fraudulent transfers as to Mr. Knipe, even though they made those distributions before they were determined to be an alter ego, or there was any judgment in favor of Mr. Knipe? Is that?
I'm not saying that they become fraudulent conveyance. They become intentional acts taken in derogation of Mr. Knipe's rights, which injured him, and part and parcel of the conspiracy was committing an abusive process by wrongfully delaying the first trial. Part of the conspiracy was creating fraudulent documents. They, from day one, when they decided not to pay Mr. Knipe in 07, their entire conduct was designed to thwart his ability to earn or recover one dime.
Thank you.
Thank you. As we've just heard, counsel for appellees has argued extensively underlying conduct from a sole and separate, completely sole and separate action. He's mixing the conduct together. It's impermissible. This instant lawsuit was to recover again the underlying judgment of $2,608,799.
What about the bankruptcy trustee?
In what regards?
Well, I mean, the bankruptcy trustee presumably was interested in recovering back assets, maybe preferential transfers to start with. I mean, I'm not sure what her claims were in the underlying suit, but can they justify that judgment on hers?
They cannot. Nevada law is clear, and it's under Nevada's version of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. It's also pinned in this court's case of Coolidge. Nevada law only allows judgments in the amount of the creditor's claim or value of transferred property, whichever is less.
Yeah.
That's the law.
Well, what was the bankruptcy trustee's claim asserted in this case?
I believe that the bankruptcy trustee's claim, I believe, was a complaint and intervention trying to recover, piggyback off of what Mr. Knipe was alleging to a certain extent.
Because she wasn't alleging fraudulent conveyances as to the general creditors that she represented.
I honestly, I'm not sure about that, but the answer to that question.
And in, in, res- In regard to what you just said about the amount of damages recoverable, that's for a fraudulent transfer claim. How does the conspiracy claim, does it fall under that or does it not necessarily fall under that?
Well, it wouldn't fall under that claim. It would be time barred, save and except for the perhaps one transaction that I was questioning about earlier, which would have been the Coolidge transaction. Worst case scenario, it would be that Mr. Mitchell and related entities would be on the hook for the $341,000 and change under the $341,934.47. That's worst case scenario. However, Nevada law says, because the underlying unlawful act here was the fraudulent transfer, Nevada law says if you're going to use that as an underlying act, you can only get the amount, which would be $341,934.47, which should be credited against the underlying judgment of $2,608,799.
Mr. Muji has argued that there were other underlying torts aside from fraudulent transfer, such as abusive process, and I think he might have tried to talk about other torts. Is that part of his claim or his client's claim, obviously?
Well, it wasn't pled that way. That may be part of what he argued at trial. It's certainly what he's arguing before this court today, but we don't find it anywhere in the pleadings. We don't find it anywhere in the calculation of damages under NRCP 16.1. It's just something that NIPE is, quote, asking for. And that's not the way the law works. You got to plead it.
I do have a couple of questions.
Sure.
The judgment does appear to include the trustee in bankruptcy. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Do you also agree that the expert who testified on behalf of NIPE identified transfers that were made from 2014 up through 2016 after the judgment was entered in favor of NIPE?
You know, the only judgment that he identified was the Coolidge transaction. The distributions and transactions he identified totally was from 2007 to 2016, of which the majority of those distributions were taken between 2007 and 2009. The only distribution that he identified was the Coolidge transaction in 2014, and he couldn't even say for sure how that, the explanation for that transfer. And the judgment takes no action whatsoever against LVLP based upon footnote number one in the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment. Very quickly, the attorney's fees calculation that the court awarded also included expert fees and costs, which is completely wrong. You're not allowed to use expert fees and costs as part of attorney's fees.
You brought up footnote one because that's part of why I went down this questioning in the first place. I'm confused by footnote one. The court takes no action against LVLP LLC, but that doesn't mean that the judgment doesn't stand in favor of the trustee in this case.
Well, in answer to your question,
I mean, to me, the judgment is a bit confusing. That's why I went down this road. Does it include, is there a judgment in favor of the trustee in this case?
And
I'm not talking about whether there's one against him. I know what footnote one says. I'm talking about the judgment appears to grant relief in favor of Las Vegas Land Partners and the trustee of the Las Vegas Land Partners.
Well, as I read the particular judgment, and I agree, this whole findings of fact, conclusions, law, and judgment is confusing. As a matter of fact, it's duplicative in many ways. Attorney's fees are awarded twice, improperly, under the fraudulent conveyance, also under the civil conspiracy. In answer to your question, I believe the answer to that is no. There is no judgment that was rendered on behalf of the bankruptcy trustee. That, to my knowledge, in reading the record.
Yeah, because the reason I went down that road is because it would seem like distributions that LVLP as an entity would be trying to claw back might be the subject of this judgment, but it's not clear.
It's not. What is clear is the amount of the compensatory damages for the civil conspiracy claim is the exact amount of all distributions that were taken by Mitchell and Lieberman in the amount of $15,148,339. That's what she did. She said, you can't take any of these. Right. And that's just not Nevada law. The other thing, real quick, if I may, again, counsel's argument completely relies and integrates and incorporates the underlying action, which is impermissible. Counsel admitted that all the other transactions in his argument today were time barred regarding the civil conspiracy.
Mr. Bryson, you've kind of gone substantially over your 2 minutes that I gave you.
Appreciate it.
And so we are done for today. We appreciate the arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and we'll stand in recess until today.